All right, welcome to the Cavis Ships Podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavis.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cavis Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII delivering the advantage.
Coming up, naval aviation took some big hits in the latest U.S. defense budget submission. Naval Air analyst and veteran Ward Carroll will be here for his take on what is going up and down with Naval Air. But first, a look at naval news this week.
Well, the fiscal year 2025 defense budget was delivered to Congress and rolled out to the media on March 11th. For a deeper discussion of the budget, we invite you to listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast of March 14th, where Chris and I join Vago Moradian and the rest of the Defense and Aerospace team to discuss the budget.
The Russian Izvestia News Service reported March 10th that the head of the Russian Navy, Admiral Nikolai Evmenov, has been dismissed and replaced by Admiral Alexander Moiseev, commander of the Russian Northern Fleet. No explanation for the move was given in the official Russian media, but the Russian Navy continues to experience losses in the war with Ukraine, including the apparent sinking of the nearly new missile corvette Sergei Kotov by Ukrainian surface drone attack in the Kerch Strait on March 5th.
The Chinese naval ships of the 45th Escort Force and the Russian destroyer Marshal Shaposhnikov arrived at the Iranian port of Chabahar March 13th after a round of naval exercises dubbed Security Bond 2024. The Chinese destroyer Urumqi, frigate Linyi, and supply ship Dongpinghu were on a regular anti-piracy deployment in the Gulf of Aden, where they were relieved on March 4th by the 46th Escort Force.
And anti-Houthi actions in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. The British frigate HMS Richmond downed two Houthi unmanned aerial drones over the Red Sea on March 8th using Sea Scepter surface-to-air missiles. The action took place as Richmond turned over Operation Prosperity Guardian duties to the British destroyer HMS Diamond, which herself downed nine Houthi UAVs earlier this year. The Italian destroyer Caio Duilio also reportedly downed two Houthi UAVs over the Red Sea on March 11th. The Italian warship is operating with the European Union's Operation Aspetus, also working to safeguard merchant shipping in the region. And on March 14th, two Houthi officials posting on X threatened to target merchant shipping in the Indian Ocean headed south around the southern tip of Africa.
Four U.S. Army watercraft left Fort Eustis, Virginia on March 12th, bound for the Mediterranean, to help build and support a pier in Gaza to supply the war-torn region with humanitarian aid. The landing ship vessel Specialist Fourth Class James A. Liu and utility landing craft Wilson Wharf, Matamoros, and Monterey are all part of the Army's 7th Transportation Brigade, part of the 18th Airborne Corps, all part of the U.S. Army's 500-soldier contribution to the U.S. government effort. The Army vessels are expected to take up to a month to cross the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. Meanwhile, elements of the Joint Logistics Over the Shore, or JLOTS, modular system are being loaded aboard the Maritime Administration roll-on-roll-off ship Benavidez at Newport News, Virginia. While these elements are being loaded and en route, plans are still being developed to field, operate, and protect the pier.
The commanding officer of the Missile Special Operations Submarine USS Ohio was relieved of command on March 13th, the U.S. Navy announced. Captain Kurt Balana of the Ohio's Gold Crew was relieved for a loss of confidence in his ability to command and replaced by the sub's prospective commanding officer, Captain Andrew Kane. The relief of the commanding officer of one of the Navy's missile submarines is considered rare.
And in new ship news, the Virginia-class attack submarine Idaho, SSN 799, was to be christened March 16th in a ceremony at General Dynamics Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut. The sub sponsor is Teresa Stackley, daughter of former Acting Secretary of the Navy Sean Stackley, and also the service's top acquisition officer from 2008 to 2017. The Idaho is the 26th Virginia-class submarine and the 13th that will be delivered from Electric Boat. And that's a look at just some of this week's naval news.
All right. It is time for the discussion portion of the podcast. And this week, we are going to talk budget, as we mentioned at the top. And rounding out the discussion group, we are joined by friend of the pod, Ward Carroll. Ward is a retired Navy commander. In his previous life, he was a radar intercept officer, F-14s. And right now, he is the host of the Ward Carroll YouTube channel. Ward, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Great to see you guys.
So, Ward, earlier in the week, we kind of did a review with Vago Maradian and the rest of the Defense and Aerospace team. And I described the budget for most of the communities as lemonade out of lemons. We had received early warnings that this was not going to be an ideal budget for any of the services, and that most of the work that was done was trying to buy back capability. You saw some of that in ships. You saw some of that in submarines. I don't think we saw that in aviation. In fact, I had the opportunity to talk to some graybeards as well as some current aviation flags who really felt like they were let down by Navy leadership in that naval aviation did not get some of the same buybacks that the rest of the communities did. Let's start with your take on the budget from an aviation standpoint. Do you share that feeling that aviation was let down, and some thoughts as to maybe why that might be?
Whether or not aviation was let down, the data suggests that it's insufficient with respect to what the requirements are. And I'm not talking about requirements in OPNAV. I'm talking about requirements vis-a-vis the real world situation that's happening, particularly in the Red Sea right now. So since October 7th, in the Hamas horrific attacks on the kibbutzes of southern Israel, there's been this draw to the Middle East in a way that we did not foresee. Originally, it was Ford's going to go to East Med and just be present, and then Ike deployed on time, but then really just bypassed the Med and went right into the Red Sea and has been there ever since. So that conflict, that element of the proxy war, the Iranian proxy war with the Houthis, is the one that is should inform the budget and our naval aviation priorities, in that you can see what CAG 3 is doing against a asymmetric as well as a second world threat with Iran. And the question isn't so much the capability of the Growler or the Super Hornet or the E-2, it's the sustainment piece. And do we have enough aircraft carriers? So, as was well documented, Ford was on deployment a lot longer than was planned. In fact, I sat down with Admiral Verissimo, who's Comnav Air Lant, at the Oceania Air Show in September, and kind of in passing during this episode at the show there, I said, "Hey, how's Ford doing?" And he went through song and verse. They're doing that shorty two-monther. They get back, quick turn, and then they're going to go on cruise for 5.5 months was the plan. And then come back and do all of the other, let's call it spiral development elements that they baked into that ambitious platform. You know, the lead ship in a new class. And the issues with Ford are well documented. You know, we've talked about them. You guys have talked about them. You know, 27 ACAT-1D programs on a single new class of ship, too many. But it's moving forward. And so my questions particularly were, how's EMALS doing? How's the advanced arresting gear doing? And how are the weapons elevators doing? And the answers were good across the board. Okay, so now fast forward. Ford goes on cruise and is surged from Central Med basically the Ionian Adriatic to Eastern Med as a result of October 7th. And they just stay there for an additional, they're extended three times. Come back. Now we've gapped coverage in the Med. We don't even have an ARG there right now in the face of what's going on with the floating dock thing that the Army is sending over there and so forth and so on. There's limited to no Navy presence in East Med. Meanwhile, on a daily basis, and I invite the listeners, if they're not already following CENTCOM on Twitter, to do so, because that shows you the cycle of what's going on here. On a daily basis, Super Hornets are shooting down surface-to-surface ballistic missiles that the Houthis are firing. And they're using not just Sidewinders, they're using AMRAAM. We can talk budget about the cost, misproportionality there. You're using a $1 to $2 million weapon to shoot down a $20,000 weapon in some cases. Not unlike what we did in the post 9/11 wars when we used JDAM to take out Nissan pickup trucks. So this budget, $16.2 billion to buy a total of 75 aircraft, is almost $1 billion less than last year's request. It's focused on JSF, both C and B variants. It's focused on Marine Corps 53Ks, the King Stallion heavy lift helicopter. And then, of course, we sprinkle in some unmanned, particularly with the MQ-25 Stingray. And then the rest is kind of, as you said, Chris, they're left wanting, particularly in the R&D, the T&E side of the house. So, on my channel, we like to get laddered up about 6th gen, right? And so the FAXX is not quite zeroed out, but it is not funded to the degree that we seem like we're enthusiastic about moving to that capability.
Well, they cut $1 billion is what you're talking. There was a R&D for that was $1.5 billion.
Yes.
Was supposed to be. And it winds up being less than half a billion.
Half a million.
So essentially, yeah. A 60 2/3 cut.
Right.
The biggest cut there, which is a huge cut.
Yes.
So go on.
So it seems kind of like status quo facing. If we're supposed to be preparing for the high-end fight, this ain't it, because as I just described at length, we're hanging on to the trailing edge with our fingertips to fight a third world threat. And again, my concern isn't whether CAG-3 and Ike Strike Group can do the job today. It's who's going to relieve them in 2 to 4 months. And then what, and so back in my day, you had a 1.0, if not 2.0 carrier quotient in those AORs, the Med at times had a 2.0 requirement in the mid to late 80s. And the Gulf never had less than one. And now, and we can say that, we're doing it smarter and so forth and so on. But the reality is we're limited in the number of strike groups, meaning the number of aircraft carriers we have. To open the aperture a little bit on this discussion, almost by happenstance, we developed the right ship against all of the actual planning to handle the current threat. And that's the Arleigh Burke class guided missile destroyer. That's the right ship to do what is being done in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. You can see in the buy or in the budget, they're zeroing out some cruisers and some other LCS, of course, and that's a whole nother conversation. So I think some of what we're seeing here is the consequence of bad planning. As we know, the budget's, 5-year defense plan, the FYDP. Previous FYDPs did poor estimation of what was going to happen, and that's a tough game anyway. So I think particularly, as you have said at the outset, Chris, the budget's insufficient for not only the tactical reality, certainly the strategic reality beyond this fit up.
Are there things in the budget that you were happy to see? We've done a good job of kind of painting the inadequacies. Was there anything in there that maybe folks can feel heartened about, or is this a D for delivery from an aviation standpoint?
I think what we're doing here, as you said, it's trying, and I'm not sure we're making lemonade out of lemons. We're trying, but this is a function of a finite amount of dollars. And I'm saying that, I mean, you make the choices you're going to make. On the Navy side, it's based on we need submarines. On the Marine Corps side, it's based on Force Design 2030. And so these are the, you know, high-level issues that inform what are we going to do with this money that's upwards of $1 billion less than we wanted. And so I think in that light, the choices they're making are sound, but I'm afraid that the budget's insufficient for what needs to be done.
There was some speculation, Ward, that the cut to FAXX may have spoken to either commitment or health of the program as early as it is. Are you hearing any of that, or do you think it's strictly a budget game at this point?
Well, I have heard that. Remember, we zeroed it out a couple of years ago, and the Air Force took the lead with their sixth-gen program, and now it's resurrected. I think we're snake bit based on the development through DT and OT, not to mention IOC, of the F-35. Remember, as we're talking, we only have two aircraft carriers that can operate with F-35Cs currently, and that's Vinson and Lincoln. Part of what's going to happen with Ford in time is it'll be, you know, fixed so that it can use F-35s in the air wing. Basically, you need thicker jet blast deflectors, and you need a different AIMD on the hangar bay set up to handle classified gear that's inherent to the F-35. But that's not a minor fix to a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. Kennedy CVN-79 will come out ready to operate F-35Cs when that's introduced, but we're talking 2026 and beyond for Kennedy. Remember, last year got slid a year. So, you know, I think the issues are big picture in terms of the macro planning we did in the previous fit up that we're wrestling with now. But again, all that having been said, as we look at the, you know, if you look at the Pentagon holistically and, you know, one third, one third, one third, I think there's an argument to be made, and I know some admirals have mentioned this to me offline, is that construct is flawed in the face of the, not just the near peer threat or the high end fight. They're flawed in the face of what's actually happening right now. And they're not having much luck at the joint staff level of changing that calculus.
I want to shift gears a little from fighters to the unmanned side of things, and particularly the MQ-25. So this is the unmanned tanker that's being developed. Ironically, it's programmed for enter low rate initial production in 2025, but an actual test article aircraft, a real MQ-25, not a modified version of something else, has yet to fly. There are only three in here. Of course, Naval Air has been touting this as something they really need for a long time to address the range issue with strike fighters being able to reach shore. And yet, whenever you ask about MQ-25, I mean, you just pretty much hear crickets. People shrug their shoulders. What's going on? What's the problems? I don't know. Boeing certainly doesn't want to talk about it. Navy's not being very talkative about it. And usually when people don't want to talk about things, it's because they have nothing good to say. There's no good news out there. What's your read on MQ-25, and where is that program? And is this, again, something that's, you know, pretty unrealistically optimistic in terms of being able to fly in a low rate production and be on a carrier flight deck in an operational sense? What's your sense of it?
My sense is it's a science project. And I don't think, and having been working at NAVAIR when we started thinking about unmanned, I don't know how serious we are about this and how holistically we're thinking. So just to review, we punted on organic carrier-based tanking when we got rid of the KA-6. And the S-3 was sort of a Band-Aid fix. But when you look at the amount of mission give a tanker needs to be of any use in terms of the pounds of gas a tanker needs to be able to deliver to the strike package, the MQ-25 is barely what we need for recovery tanker. And so this is not a serious platform to solve the tanking problem, as you describe. So what I think this is, and remember originally, like, let's make this a strike platform. And then NAVAIR is like, that's too complicated. There's too many moving parts there. So let's just make it a tanker. And so everybody's doing their best. The program office, where, oh, by the way, all the talent is focused right now. You know, it's funny. The competencies move the talent from B-22 to F-35 now to the unmanned side at NAVAIR. And these are the same guys. You know, you talk to the engineer who was there when I was working V-22 is now working unmanned, and the contract specialist and the weapon system integration and so forth and so on. And so I'm not, this isn't an indictment of the folks who are doing the hard work. It is more a question of what is our intent? So I think this is part of what you have to go through to get to a meaningful unmanned capability. So this is going to be a necessary interim step. It'll take us a decade or more to push past the Stingray into something that's actually of any utility, because the devil is in the details. As an aviator, a carrier-based aviator, I'm like, how does the mobility tack note work with MQ-25s? Like case one pattern, how do you integrate an unmanned airplane? Not to mention case three. And so I think you need something like this that's semi-innocuous, of limited capability, to figure out those details. And then you'll build bigger ones, more capable ones, ones that actually have some meaningful give after that. And then ones that have offensive capability as well. But that's 25, 30 years off. So, I mean, we say unmanned, it's kind of a buzzword around the building and around the systems commands. So I when I hear that stuff, I it's kind of an eye roll for me. And again, having worked in the procurement side and the acquisition side, I know this is kind of what you have to go through to get to something that ultimately is has some utility.
You know, you talked about what the Eisenhower's doing in the Red Sea, and by the way, it's been operating the Red Sea for quite some time now, which I really wasn't expecting. It's not a good environment for aircraft carriers. It's pretty tight.
They,
in there.
They really weren't expecting it either.
Yeah, well.
Errol Miguez and CAG Scott, they were right. Not, this isn't what they thought they'd be doing.
But at the moment, it's going on and on. I'm not sure how long this is going to go on. And you just said what's next and all this. But the mission has certainly been there. So, you know, the destroyers have been validating themselves. The aircraft have been in action against real world targets repeatedly and apparently fairly successfully. And that's good. Not too long ago, in the late summer, we had eight aircraft carriers. 8 of 11 aircraft carriers were actually underway at the same time, screws turning. Really an unprecedented percentage. A lot of that was sort of an accident. It wasn't planned that way. But be that as it may, that was a lot. There were actually 4 deployed. We had 2 pairs of carriers both in the Western Pacific and in the Eastern Med, almost back to back, and four others operating around the U.S. in various states of readiness. That's unheard of. There's a backside to that, and that is that if everybody's running at some point, they're going to, in a year or so, everybody's not going to be running. And that was the case right 3 years ago or so. There were only like three carriers running. Most people were in the yards one way or another. In any case, these are cycles, and they're very, very, very difficult to manage. Real world keeps getting in the way. The Ford is extended, Eisenhower is extended, blah, blah. But the carriers have been busy. The carriers have been front and center. They certainly got a ton of publicity, a lot of it intended, a lot of it managed, but people definitely went there, especially in the late summer, especially in the fall, and over the winter. And so as a symbol of national intent and national power, they seem to remain pretty potent. On the other hand, last few weeks, there's a whole nother round of articles and opinions coming out about the carriers had its day and it's too expensive and it's too vulnerable. And why are we doing this? This is sort of another, you know, cycle that goes around and around and around. But here we are again with another one. And in the face of that, the budget cuts naval aviation for whatever reason. And there's a lot of this is not simple stuff. And by the way, the budget was pretty much laid out before the Hamas war and before the Houthi operation. So all that's kind of happened since and not reflected in the budget yet. But the budget did push back the aircraft carrier centers, which is something Newport News, the only builder of ships, of aircraft carriers, Newport News Shipbuilding has been warning against and lobbying against for a long time. They didn't want that to happen. And yet it just did. So they pushed back a carrier from 28 and that was scheduled for 2028 into 2030. The carrier after that's going to get pushed back and undetermined. We don't know yet, but it's still going back. This exacerbates the supply chain, a lot of things. So there are all these trends and these things that are going on is sort of the point. But I mean, do you see a picture there, or is it something that opponents will exploit? Or is this a result of a coordinated effort, or is it just individual situations in these different areas that are sort of having an impact? I mean, do you see anything? I mean, how do you sort of go with that flow?
Well, I think the situation is sort of as it's ever been, which is, you know, requirements are predictive in nature, and so you have to. You know, I remember when the Quadrennial Defense Review in the middle of the post 9/11 wars did this thing called the Pacific Pivot. Remember that? And so like in the height of when we're all in on MRAPs and body armor and stuff to counter IEDs, suddenly somebody on high, I don't know if it was Gordon England or whomever, just said, okay, we're not worried about asymmetric warfare anymore. And now we're pivoting to this peer threat. And at the time I was at military.com as the editor. And I'm like, what, how is this even like a thing in the face? And I got a little cynical about, you have to create a threat in order to inform a budget and so forth and so on. So I think there's always some of that, and it's finite. And As you say, this what we're looking at here in terms of the specifics was pre this situation that we're dealing with in the Gulf particularly. Meanwhile, the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese just did an exercise for the second year in a row in the Gulf, and that is the definition of the threat right now. And by all accounts, it went well, and they're getting along famously. And so that's what we got to think about. So I think to your point, Chris, is that criticism of the aircraft carrier has had its day is always out there. And I know that if you look at the white papers, particularly Force Design 2030, and what the Secretary of the Air Force just came up with, you know, a major reorganization of the Air Force, necessary, but also forward-leaning in terms of what we think will be the threat in 5 to 10 years. And history shows we're not really good at that kind of predictive work. So I think what this budget says is we don't want conventional weaponry to include aircraft carriers. And we think that things like, you know, the EW spectrum and unmanned are the value adds where you're going to create firepower leveraging technology and so forth and so on. However, the real world always mitigates the realization of that thesis, and we're always burned and we find ourselves wanting. And as we've described, we don't have enough aircraft carriers. Yes, we had 8 at sea. You know, some of them were dragging screws. Others were not, had no sortie generation capability. But yes, we had 8 at sea. And as you also suggest, Chris, now we're paying for it with, you know, both midterm and long-term maintenance. I was just down in Norfolk talking again to Admiral Verissimo aboard the Ford. And we had 3 carriers on the pier. You had Ford, GW, which did my heart good as the last carrier that I deployed on, and Harry S. Truman on the pier at Norfolk. Across the river, you had Kennedy being built, and you had George H.W. Bush in long-term maintenance. And then you had Stennis going through an RCOH. And meanwhile, you got Ike underway. One of all of those carriers is actually underway currently on the East Coast. So that's different than 8 carriers underway, which you're like, ta-da. And we remember during Desert Storm, we paid for that 7 carrier presence for years in terms of op tempo after that. And so, again, I think the number should be 15 instead of 9 to 11 in terms of the number of Nimitz / Ford class carriers we need. And as you say, right now we can't even figure out a multi-year buy for Ford class carriers. And every time you don't do that, like you say, Chris, you push the you know, first deployment out a year or so. I'm just afraid we keep doing this to the degree that ultimately we're going to be facing the Chinese or the Russians or the Iraqis or the Iranians, and it's going to be serious shit.
Ward, I want to take the time that we have left and I want to talk ordnance. We've kind of been around everything. We've talked about on this show, and you alluded to it, the mismatch in, taking on an asymmetric threat. I mean, there's this thought that, whether it's surface ships, whether it's aviation squadron, that we don't have enough of what we need. What's your sense of that on the aviation side? What do you hear?
Well, I think we're fine with existing stocks, both surface warfare and air-to-air warfare. Certainly the plan, whether it's Standard Missile 6 or LRASM or AMRAAM-ER, they're not going to get any cheaper. So it doesn't seem we're terribly concerned about that cost disparity between, you know, what we're shooting the bad guys down with and what the bad guys are paying for what they're shooting at us. Our capabilities are going to be better in the future. I don't know if we're doing hypersonics enough. That's another R&D thing that maybe we're not focused on enough. So again, the Houthi war is a proof of concept. And that's a third world enemy. Imagine that it's China or even Iran, and you have greater capability then. So we're able to counter that threat to a reasonable extent. Again, every once in a while, a weapon will get through and hit a commercial ship and came real close to hitting gravely. They had to use SeaWiz to knock down one of those ballistic missiles a few weeks ago. And my fear is that they'll do a swarm or, you know, a fusillade of ballistic missiles, and we won't have enough assets to knock them all down. I think that's what they're pulsing to maybe ultimately do. So like every other part of this budget, it seems that we're insufficiently serious about the high-end threat and countering particularly the China threat. And so, you know, that's what I'm seeing on the ordnance side.
I'll ask one last question and then we'll have to wrap. But on the surface side, again, we've talked about it. There is a glass half full. There is a this was needed, right? I mean, you don't start conflicts because you want the practice, but the practice that these surface crews are seeing, the op tempo, there's a feeling that it's been good, that it was needed, that it will help the warfighting culture that Navy leadership is trying to instill in these ships. Do you get the same sort of glass half full on the aviation side, that as you begin to wrap your mind around the high end threat, even though this isn't the high end threat, that this these actions will better prepare the aviation force for what could come in the future?
No, I think the only winner here is the surface warfare community. You know, the fact that Super Hornets are even engaged and involved is lost on lawmakers. I think what you're seeing is everybody's giving, you know, the love appropriately to the Arleigh Burks and the small boys. And so the question there is, okay, could we give you better standard missiles? And what else could we give you in terms of the electronic warfare capability that would alleviate the inventory concerns, which there really aren't any, as far as I'm hearing of, you know, there's plenty of standard missiles in theater. They have 94X aboard any one of those ships. And if they need to go to Bahrain, they will. And sometimes they even go through the ditch again and go into the Med and get resupplied. I think that's happened a couple of times. Kearney had to resupply early on and then came back. So I don't think aviation is benefiting from the Houthi war to the degree that surface warfare is. So I think this is lost on the people, the budgeteers, in a way that is could be a problem.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Folks, we've been talking with former naval aviator Ward Carroll, host of the very popular Ward Carroll channel on YouTube. Ward, thanks again for being on the podcast. It's always good to have you on. We really appreciate your insight.
It's always great to talk to you guys. Thank you.
That does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vaga Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support.
The Cavishes podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is one of the largest artificial intelligence and machine learning federal contractors to the U.S. government. HII, delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavish Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavish. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.